Hello world, it's me, Dennis, and today I have the pleasure of talking with Dr. Adam Frank. What a time to talk to a scientist. I mean, this is thank you for taking the time, not just for taking the time, but for the breadth of your work.
Well, thank you.
It is so cool to meet a conscious being who is looking at himself and looking at the world and saying just, wow, what's going on here?
Yeah. Well, this is weird.
I know. And not just weird. I mean, even before this, it is weird.
The whole kit and caboodle.
Yeah.
The whole catastrophe, as they say, of being alive on the world is just, yeah. It's just strange. Yeah. No, I'm always amazed that more people aren't like, you know, waking up every morning just being like, whoa, another one of these, you know, another day. Okay. You know?
Yeah. It's extraordinary. This idea of consciousness, this idea of how this works, this awareness of ourselves is just now how I'm really into origin stories. Like when I read about Feynman, I'm really interested in like him as a little boy, how his father, a non-scientist, got him excited about, look, if a T-Rex were this tall, it would be looking out your bedroom window. Now, why is that?
Yeah.
So tell me yours. Tell me some of your origin stories and just dip into your repertoire and tell us something that we haven't.
We're just the audio.
Yeah, no, the video stopped for a second. We can always glue that together.
No, I'm questioning. So we are recording videos. This is both.
Yeah. I was recording it, and you look marvelous. This 72-year-old this month is so happy to see such a child, such a younger cousin who is here and getting ready onto that. So go for it.
Okay. So the my origin story is that I was raised in New York City, or the environments. I grew up actually in New Jersey, the industrial parts of New Jersey. And my dad was a writer and not a scientist, but he had a strong interest in science. And what happened for me was that he had a lot of science fiction, those pulp magazines, you know, Astounding Fiction.
All those writers made their money. Heinlein and all of them made their money in that pulp fiction
world. Right. It was an amazing time because those guys were really setting the foundation for, you know, the imagination of the world we live in now. You know, they were imagining the world we live in now. And it was all in those, you know, those little crappy, crappy paper magazines. But, you know, the artwork, the famous artwork on the front of those, that's what got me. I was about 5 years old and I would like look at my dad's, I'd come down to his library and I'd look at his, the covers of those magazines. And, you know, there were pictures of bug-eyed monsters, but really what got me were the pictures of like, you know, astronauts bouncing around on you know, jagged mountains of the moon or whatever in their Michelin tire spacesuits. that just fueled my imagination. So I fell in love with astronomy then. And as I like to say, the affair never cooled. So my dad was great that he took me to the Hayden Planetarium, you know, which is where many young astronomer, you know, learned his or found his passion. Yeah. So we'd go to that almost every other weekend. And much to my sister's chagrin.
Yeah.
That's what really did it for me, is that was got started. And so I knew, you know, there was never any question for me about what I wanted to do. I knew I wanted to be an astronomer. I knew that, I was interested in physics, but I also discovered early on Carl Sagan's writing. So, you know, like, again, like many people, Carl Sagan was my introduction to, science and physics. And of course his writing was so broad. Yeah. Right.
God.
So he was like, he'd tell you about relativity, but in telling you about relativity, he'd also tell you about 15th century Venice. And that, you know, that kind of style of thinking about science and culture broadly is something I got infected with very early And that, you know, is very much my writing now, still has that. I'm interested in everything. Like, there's no part of experience that's not weird and worth attention.
So how did you at the time deal when you got the flush of testosterone coming out of your and started flooding? What years were those, and what was the culture like when that happens? Because testosterone is a really major drug to be flooding into these little boys. I mean, it's hard as shit to be able to deal with it.
Yeah, no, it's true. So teenager, so I was already heavily into science fiction, and mm-hmm. I read a lot of comic books too. I was a big Marvel fan.
Yeah.
And those actually helped quite a bit. So I grew up in a town called Belleville, New Jersey, which is an Italian, Irish, Roman Catholic neighborhood. I was the only Jew in the entire town, which is funny because, you know, my parents weren't religious, but, so, you know, it was a great place. I mean, the people were awesome. It was, you know, it was a trip growing up there. You know, a lot of low level crime, you know.
Yeah.
But in a way that somehow I always, you know, was always kind of, I knew I was going to be an astronomer. So everything I got involved with was just more, you know, more experience in some way. So, the funny thing about my high school was, you know, it wasn't very difficult. So it wasn't like, they weren't pushing me, but I learned all kinds of great things that have actually, you know, served me well over time. Someday I'm going to write a book called Everything I Needed to Know I Learned from New Jersey.
There you go.
Yeah. So, and then also I had New York too. You know, I started much of my family lived in Manhattan or around those environments. So I started going into New York, you know, from an early age, and that city, in many ways, you know, the complexity of that city, the richness of that city also fueled my imagination and my ambition, you know, to understand things. There's a way in which New York, you know, when you're walking around New York, the city kind of leans down on you and says, who the hell do you think you are? You know, and you have to kind of rise up and be like, hey, I've got ideas too, you know. So, yeah, that was helpful. But I knew I wanted to get the hell out of there. Yeah. So I did my undergraduate in Colorado, in Boulder, Colorado.
Oh, what a great place. What year was that?
That was 80. I got out there.
So that was the 80s. This was after the 60s, when the 60s went, they went through that amazing transformation during the 60s.
Yeah.
Now you get to get there. So what was Boulder like then?
Boulder then, by that time, you know, it was called the place where the hip meet to trip, right? This was very much the drug era. And it would already become, you know, it was the 80s, so money was starting to come, really start to matter. So it still had that kind of hippie thing going on. But all of the rich people sent their kids to Colorado, to Boulder, because of the skiing. And I actually went there because of the skiing, too. I had started, you know, in New Jersey, I had actually picked up the bug, which in New Jersey is pretty funny because, you know, they just basically hose down garbage dumps and you ski down them. So I got out there, and what was funny was it was basically, it was a party school. But luckily for me, it was also a powerhouse of astronomy. So I was the only, of all my friends, I was the only one who actually studied. So that was kind of funny. And we know what's interesting about that, too. It was also one of the places where astrobiology was beginning.
Yeah.
So this is in the 80s. And it was just at the beginning when people were beginning to think differently about life in the universe. You know, like the field of astrobiology as an experimental science in terms of looking at extremophiles and things like that on Earth. That was happening there. So Chris McKay, who's one of the founders, you know, the modern founders of astrobiology, was my TA. He was a graduate student there for my undergrad.
Oh my God! Cool.
I was talking with him, and I still, you know, I see him every now and then. But So Boulder was the other important thing for me about Boulder was that it was also the home of the Naropa Institute, which was the first Buddhist university in America. So Allen Ginsberg was out there and other people. And I had already started to develop an interest in contemplative practice. Yeah. So that was an interesting thing as well. So my first meditation intensive, I did a Shambhala intensive of 2 days of meditation. I was like 19 years old, you know. And that was fascinating because that was my introduction to the, you know, contemplative practice and its importance.
All right, man. I have been doing a thought experiment that the distance from the tip of my nose to the light cone at the absolute farthest that there could possibly be is exactly the same distance in parsecs from the tip of my nose to the center of my soul. That there is a balance here. So I just get to say that to a scientist and a practitioner of meditation. So thank you for allowing me to say that. However it is. So how did that change you? How did that suddenly, that opportunity to explore your inner universe and to say that in that particular way, how did that make an impact on you,
Adam?
Well,
it's interesting. So one part of the biography that's important is that when I had a brother who was killed in a car accident when I was 9 and he was 15, a drunk driver came across the side of the road and killed him and 3 other people in a car. So that experience, you know, I had a lot of grief and a lot of anger, you know, which was, you know, that's also part of, you know, growing up in Jersey too. Some of the stuff I was involved in was playing out. So, you know, I mean, like many people, I came to contemplative practice, you know, because I was interested in deep questions, but also because I needed to deal with my, you know,
interior
landscape. So, you know, that the experience of contemplative practice was useful just in seeing that, you know, what you think when, you know, is not who you are, right? That there's this level of, you know, the roof brain activity, you know, of just thoughts. There's a lot more to being conscious than just rational thought, you know, that there's other below it. You know, you see anybody who has to sit for more than, you know, if you do an intensive for more than a few days, learns that like the rational thought is just the, you know, or the discursive thought. Let me put it that way. Discursive thought is just upper layer, and there's all these deeper layers, you know, which are, you know, very difficult to access, and, you know, it's unclear what access means.
Right.
But, you know, that said, it launched me. First of all, there was a stillness in there that was very useful for just dealing with, you know, the grief I was carrying around. Wow. And then as time went on, you know, I got established in Buddhist practice. I've been doing, you know, as I say, I've been staring at a wall for 30 freaking years or more. And, you know, you learn things from doing that. You learn things about the nature of awareness, right? The stabilization of attention, which I think is very useful if you're interested in the scientific study of consciousness.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So. And how that arose. I'm all right. So you get out of school, right?
And then what did I do then? Then I took a year and a half off because I really needed some time off. And then I did like everything. I was, I went back to New York for a while. I was a bouncer at the Rocky Horror Picture Show on 8th Street, which was a trip and a half. I was a foot messenger for a long time. That was a lot of fun and a lot of very weird. And then I ended up, because that was my plan. I had a friend of mine who was Canadian. And there's I think it still exists, this job up there in resource management called tree planting, where basically you go out for like 3 or 4 months into the bush of British Columbia, and you know, you're living in camps, bush camps, and you're, you know, literally you're going out into these clear cuts with, you know, 100 pounds of seedlings in a bag and scrambling over, you know, it's unbelievably hard work in the most beautiful, crazy environments you could imagine. So I did that for a while. That was, and everybody doesn't get the money. It actually pays very well, you know.
Yeah.
It's piecework, you know. You get like 25 cents for every seedling you put in. So that, you know, that year and a half off, I did lots of other things, you know, all kinds of different jobs, you know, was a waiter. And that was all great. But it also taught me like, oh, my God, I need to get back to the I went back to university and, you know, grabbed those big marble columns. Like, oh, God, let me back, please. So I did that for a year and a half, and then the interesting thing about that was one of the last jobs I did, and I was there for about 7 months. I went back to New York City after the tree planting, and I got a job as a scientific programmer at the Goddard Institute for Space Studies, which is a NASA installation on 113th Street and Broadway. It's right over the restaurant that, you know, if you have in Seinfeld, right? You know, the old 19, that diner.
Yeah.
This is so weird. There's a NASA climate facility above there. And so what was interesting about that for me was, you know, not only was it one of my first scientific jobs, but I remember one day asking, you know, after working there for, you know, about a month and learning, I was doing like, you know, some basic programming. And I went to my boss, Inez Fung, and said, you know, well, what exactly are we studying here? And this is 1985. And she lays out for me the argument for climate change, right? This is 85. Nobody had heard about climate change before. And she says to me, well, we think human activity may be changing the climate. We're running models of what that would look like. And we're, you know, starting to look for the signal that we're changing the climate, right? And I said, well, what's going to happen if we change the climate? And then she lays out that whole thing. And I remember walking out, my mind was blown. I walk out onto and walk down to Riverside Park, and I walk down, I'm just like, you know, WTF, like, oh, the world's going to end. Like, what are you talking about? And I try to tell my friends, I'm like, dude, you know, that night in a bar, I'm like, dude, you know, we're going to change the climate.
Yeah.
The oceans are going to rise. And everyone's like, yeah, man.
Yeah, man, sure, thanks.
And so that was my introduction. So, like, unlike most people, you know, I got steeped in climate change long before there was any evidence that, just, you know, clear evidence that it was happening. And then by 88, my mid-90s, clear evidence existed. So I've always had a long, long interest in climate change. So, yeah, that's where that started. Then I went to the University of Washington in Seattle. I got for graduate work. I had a fellowship there. And I was there for about 6 years, which was also Pacific North. Fell in love with the Pacific Northwest. That's a whole, you know, trip in itself. So, and then after that, you know, postdoc, and then, you know, was very lucky to land a job in upstate New York. Came back to the East Coast, which I love. And I've been here.
Were you writing all this time? Did the stimulation of what is this narrative ability, your wordsmithery, to be able to put these words together and really to connect them to a story that can...
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So, you know, like I said, my dad was a writer. My mom was a writer, too. And my mom was my first writing teacher in many ways. You know, we'd have some assignment, you know, in school, and I'd come back and I'd bring it to her. And she would go through it. And I remember, like, this one piece of advice. She says, this sentence, it's got elbows in it. You know, this is an awkward sentence. You should always shoot for short sentences, short descriptive sentences with action words. You know, she told me this when I was like 9.
Right.
So I was lucky to have, yeah, some really good writing teachers, you know, my parents early on, my mom in particular. And then I remember the day that I had some really great friends who are still great friends in graduate school. And we were in an argument. We were arguing about whether or not physics was a language, mathematical physics was a language, because I'm a theorist, you know, so I'm enamored of mathematical physics. And we were arguing about this, and my buddy had been he used to work for the Exploratorium, the museum, the amazing museum in San Francisco, and they had a small magazine that would do thematic issues. And he's like, well, if you're so sure of this, I just got the flyer from them calling for articles, and this next issue is going to be on language. So I was like, great. So that was the first piece I ever wrote, which was, you know, is mathematical physics a language? And that's what started it. And then I was very lucky. The second piece I wrote for them, the guest editor was Casey Cole, who's one of the great science writers in the United States. And so she and I, you know, became very good friends. She eventually went to Discover Magazine as one of their top writers. Oh. And she started taking articles from me. So that is what allowed me to then start a career as a science communicator, as a, you know, and then by mid 2000s, I was at the point where I was kind of didn't want to do science journalism anymore. I wanted to write about my own ideas. And that's where my first book on science and religion came from.
So can we spend a little time there?
Sure.
Because I'm fascinated with this concept. I love consciousness, and I love the idea, you know, like Feynman says, God is too big for the stage. You know, we just can't. Of course, he also said, "Shut up and calculate." So that's another another piece we'll discuss. But anyhow, in that this idea of where there is a disconnect, where there really shouldn't be, and there should, when there's so much overlap in what we're doing. And I love, like, when you were talking about in your TED talk, which I advise anyone, it will be on the link, where you're talking about, instead of talking about this from the religious standpoint, what if we dug deeper and talked about what was the impelling drive below, and let's go there.
Yeah, the aspiration. That's what the first book was about aspiration. Yeah, you know, so I think the science versus religion debate, you know, yeah, right. The problem with that is it's really, you're not talking about science What you're talking about is you're talking about science and political entities, right? Because human, so the term I use is human spiritual endeavor, right? So the idea that, like, you know, there's been, if you look at like the history of scholarship about religion, there was this recognition around the early 1900s that there was a difference between the experience that people have in what would we call a religious context and the, you know, the socio-political forms that are, you know, that go emerge around that. So people like Marcia Eliade was someone I read a lot of. Actually, what happened for that book, my university's great in that it allows me, they have these things called bridging fellowships. And I got to spend 6 months in the religion and classics department at my university reading like the canon of religious studies. And religious studies is different from theology, right? Yeah. You know, it looks sure. at religion as a broad human phenomenon. So, you know, what is important there is that, you know, human beings have always had this call to the sacred. Right now, the sacred is something, you know, you want to be careful about how you define it, what you mean about it. But sacredness is really an experience, right? So for hunter-gatherers, there would be a glade or a rock or a tree that, you know, and anybody who hikes has this experience, right? You come to some place that just is like, whoa, you know, there's some mojo here, right? So this has nothing to do with a conception, a dogma about a deity or not a deity, whatever. You know, this is about this human experience. And so there's like the, you know, one of the most famous important books in this is William James, The Variety of Religious Experience, right? Where he goes through and he interviews lots of people and, you know, he talks about that people have this experience and that it's universal and it's ancient, right? So I, you know, so one of the reasons I really like the word sacred rather than spirituality or something that I'll use both is that what sacred refers to specifically is Roman temple architecture. You know, it has nothing to do with like, you know, what happened to you in church or in synagogue or whatever. Because the sacer was the interior domain of the temple. And that's where you had to attend to the needs of the gods. That's where your attention, your focus was different. As opposed to the profanum, which was the region outside where you could sell your Grateful Dead tapes and your peanuts and everything. So, you know, that's why there's this difference between the sacred and the profane. So the sacred is really an attitude. It's an approach. It's an attentiveness. And what I was arguing in the book was that this whole debate about science and religion misses the whole point, because what we really should focus on is people's experience of what they respond to as being sacred. And my argument was that science has always been one route to respond to that. So that, you know, the aspiration to know the true and the real, capital T, capital R, is something that is common to science and human spiritual endeavor. And then, of course, like everything with human beings, you know, at some point that endeavor may become, may develop structures that have politics in them. And I'm not interested in the politics. I'm not interested in the dogma, because I would consider myself an atheist. I'm atheistic. That kind of idea doesn't make much sense. But I have a profound sense of the more, you know, that there's more than just, you know, than you know, just the accounts of the world that come in science. There's many other ways to apprehend truth in the world than just science. But science is exactly. Comes from that aspiration.
And so I've been thinking about this for a long time, and I was thinking about what if God was love. No, I mean, actually the experience of love that all of us would experience is a tiny little filtered through all that, an experience of what it actually is. And then people surround around that experience of love and begin to build a dogma out from it and try to describe it in some way. But that experience of love that all of us get a chance to experience one is a filtered down of whatever that I'm trying to describe as.
Right. Well, you know, there's Armstrong. I've forgotten her first name. The author who, you know, has written beautifully on religion. You know, she has this idea that the golden rule. You know, the golden rule is common to all religions, which is do unto others as one would have do unto to oneself, which also is kind of an expression of love and is an expression sure of that. So that idea, you know, what we call love, you know, love, there's, it's, you know, apply the word. It's this sort of, what it is a sense of connection, connectedness,
Thank you.
And I think that is what's at the root. And this is what contemplative practice, you know, happens in contemplative practice. Once you get, you know, after spending hours and hours and hours, you know, and with training, training in contemplative practice, and you learn, because what you learn in contemplative practice is the to stabilize your attention. Because that's the problem with the mind. I mean, you know, listen, the mind evolved to do this. It's great, but it kind of bounces around. You know, it's this, sure, that, this, that. And with contemplative practice, you know, you learn to sort of stabilize that. And then other aspects of being conscious can become, can come to the fore. And, you know, that sense of a profound, non-discursive connectedness is pretty much what everybody describes, a sense of unity, oneness, you know, whatever. And
exactly.
You don't have to get, I mean, you don't have to get woo about it. I mean, it is woo in the sense of like, it's profound. The, you know, those experiences are amazing. But, you know, it lives at some root level of to be aware of this organ, any organism that is self-aware or has awareness at all. In some sense, I think that that connectedness is just part of it, part of the experience.
That is beautifully said. Thank you. God, thank you. That is that connects me. So I mean, I do meditate and I have done some meditation. I've never gone to the places you've gone. I have done it psychedelically. So I did it through mushrooms, and I did it through, but what that gave me and like everyone I know virtually who's ever done it, is that all it does is it gives you an idea of what's there. And then you have to go back and go, all right, now do the hard work to get there.
Yeah, right. That's
pretty the hard much, work. It's just a short, all right, we'll give you a preview of coming attractions.
Yeah.
Now go back and do the damn work.
You know, what's interesting is that, you know, so, you know, I do Zen. That's the form of Buddhism I practice. And, you know, when you do like an intensive, you do a 7-day intensive, which is intense. You know, you'll start to, you know, have experiences, you know, they call them makyos, you know, we're basically, you know, because with Zen, you're, you know, you meditate with your eyes open and you'll see on the screen in front of you, you'll just like, whoa, what is going on? And I remember going to the, you know, you have regular meetings with the teacher, and I remember going to the Roshi and being, you know, explaining this, and he's like, yeah, that's great, but, you know, don't pay attention to the scenery, you know, because like, that's not the point, you know, once attention starts to stabilize, then, you know, the perceptive organs, ears are going to start, they're just going to start going off on their own. The first, during that, you know, I described that first meditation intensive I had. So that was 2 days, and it was really hard, right? Anybody who's done meditation in the beginning, it's so hard because it's so
God, yes.
Boring.
Yes.
It's boring. Right? Yes. But that's what you got to get through that, because the mind is like, oh, give me something. So one of the things that happened was, it was on day two, and I'm sitting there and I'm just struggling to like keep sitting there. And I had, you know, I'm a big Bruce Springsteen fan, of course, coming from New Jersey. And I had the entire Born to Run album track through from side one through side two, including the little gaps in the between the song. It was just to make, because my mind was like, hey man, I need something. So like, here, I'm just going to throw this at you. Enjoy it, you know? But one of the most amazing things that happened in that experience was that I had reached a point where I was like, that's it. Fuck it. I'm getting out of here, you know? And just as that was rising, like I was ready to get up and leave, you know, the whole point of that meditation practice is like, whenever you have thoughts, you know, whenever you lose the breath practice, just label it thinking and let it go. So just when I was at the peak of like, I'm done with this, you know, thinking, I let it go. And it was like, wow, all that emotion, all that intensity, just bloop, it's gone. And that was my first recognition that like, oh, you know, there's really something, it's not this stuff that's just running through your head. There's more to being aware than just those thoughts. You know, there's something below this. And now if you can get past the boredom and in my thinking scientifically about life and about cognition, and, you know, this plays a big role for me now, because now, you know, now that I see, I think, you know, this is one of the things I think it's crazy is we have this whole philosophy of mind. You know, we have these domains of velocity of mind and neuropsychology, you know, and that, you know, contemplative practice is not part of that, which seems a little ridiculous, because how can you have a philosophy of mind if you haven't examined your own, you know? Because, you know, the weird thing about consciousness is one of the few things that third person accounts just are, you know, it's unique. consciousness is unique, and the third person accounts are really not going to do much for you, or there's only so much they're going to be able to do.
I was thinking about that, about what would the next math look like if it had subjective variables that you actually had to put in the consciousness. Because I mean, what the hell is that? When you look at a photon, at a photon, and it decides whether or not it wants to be a wave or a particle, depending upon whether or not you look at it. What the hell are you talking about?
Yeah, but I mean, I've thought about this a lot. It's not clearly.
I really want you. Thank you. Help me to think about this differently.
Well, I mean, this is an open question. It's not clear to me that you're going to be able to have the kind of mathematized account of awareness, of self-awareness.
Exactly.
Hallmark of science, because it's just, I mean, it's possible, but I think one has to be very careful, because the problem is, the whole thing about experience is that it is immediate, it is self-contained, it is there's a word for it, it's autopoetic, it bootstraps itself, and so trying to account for as a third person, or in a mathematical formalism, it's you may just end up
never get there.
Out the very thing that you're looking for. So I'm not sure
exactly. I totally get that there isn't a way, because by thinking about it,
that's changing. That's open. I mean, maybe not. I think I'm not. It's not clear that there's going to be.
Yeah.
We're gonna need. So, you brought up quantum mechanics, which is interesting. So, one of the interesting things that happened while I was in Boulder, right? Boulder, that was the era of Fritz-Dorf Capra and his book, the Tao of Physics, which I have to tell you is wrong. Totally, totally wrong. And I'll tell you why it's wrong. So that whole sort of new age. Consciousness of, the observer affects the observed. The problem with that was quantum mechanics is remarkable. It's amazing, but it's got no interpretation. It doesn't come, unlike Newtonian physics, which was kind of obvious what was meant by it. Quantum mechanics has no interpretation. It's agnostic to interpretations. And what that whole new age thing did is it chose one interpretation, the Copenhagen, and said, "Oh, that's what quantum mechanics tells us."
Yeah,
but there's the problem with interpretations is they're just interpretations. So you can't just choose one and say that's what quantum mechanics says, because there's things like the multi-world many worlds interpretation, which I hate, but it's still, that one is just as valid as Copenhagen. So you can't say that, oh, look, this interpretation, which fits Buddhism, is the one that we're going to take. So it's a much more open, interesting question now. So I'm just actually, I'm part of a group that, we are now looking at classical Eastern philosophies. The philosophies of India and Asia, and their philosophies, not as like, oh, this shows, quantum mechanics shows this is true, but instead saying, look, these came from a different line of reasoning, a different they had a different focus, right? The Western philosophies, because it was a monotheistic, had this sort of view of like, oh, what you really want is the God's eye view of the world. Right. Yeah. That's what science is going to give us, the view that, the objective, perfectly objective God's eye view. Classical India and classical Asian philosophies, because of their emphasis, particularly on contemplative practice, were much more about epistemology, how you knew things, rather than ontology, which was what the Western was focusing on.
Oh.
So, one of the things we're looking at, and we'll see where it goes, is how people like Nagarjuna, who was he was the Plato or whatever, the Aristotle of Indian philosophy, Shantideva, these were all like giants, these were super smart, really clear thinkers, how their views, there was a philosophical movement called Yogacara, which was very much had elements that, echo sort of what happened in continental philosophy at the turn of the century, people like Husserl and Heidegger, what's called phenomenology. So, those views may have, it's not like, oh, quantum mechanics shows they're right. No, not at all. It's, can we use the ideas from these philosophical backgrounds and see if there's anything we can tell that might be helpful in interpreting quantum mechanics, more than that, in suggesting new experiments? Because the point of science, right, is not like having some interpretation that you glue onto your science because you've got a philosophical bias. It's, is this philosophical perspective helpful in suggesting new experiments that could tell one one interpretation from the other. So I think that's like super interesting and super exciting, but it's very different from sort of quantum mechanics has a lot to teach us, but it's not, and I really caution against, if we're interested in science and Buddhism in particular, quantum mechanics is not really the place you want to look. It's much more the mind sciences that I think is going to be some, you know, the most interesting places to connect them to.
So you who look out to the universe and what things are going on, how do you choose? How do you collate something to be of interest in, to spend time when you know that there could be thousands of lifetimes that you could possibly do? What is Adam's, what's on your, on
well, when
deck,
you say thousands of lifetimes, are you talking about reincarnation?
No. I meant thousands.
Yeah, because I'm not really sure what to do with that.
That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about thousands of current lifetimes.
Right. No. I mean, God, that's right. I mean, everything is interesting. Everything is
subtle
and complex. So how the hell do you decide? And life is finite. I'm now 57. Yeah. And I don't know how many more years I'm going to get, especially with what's going on now.
So
I mean, it's really hard because I've got, I mean, I, you know, this is the dilemma every day because I have a research group that does my research group with my graduate students. And, you know, we're well funded to study astrophysical fluid dynamics. So we study things like how stars form out of clouds and like giant clouds in space.
Yeah.
We study things like planets, how planets can lose their atmosphere when they're because of starlight boiling away the atmosphere. Yeah, you know, so very bread and butter kind of astrophysical topics, which is, you know, is beyond beautiful.
Oh, yeah.
But at the same time, I'm also interested, you know, now I'm doing a lot of work on the evolution of civilizations and planets together, right? That idea has gotten really, I'm really interested in that. So this is this whole idea of complex adaptive systems, which connects to network theory. You know, and that's pretty complex stuff, and you can't just sort of dabble in it. And then I'm doing a lot of work on...
All right, but I want to start stick with number two before we get to number three.
Right.
Is there a group around the world? Because I was thinking about how this was when in the 50s you wanted to get an idea out and to share it and to be able to go. And the difference between now and 2020, you want to connect with other people who are thinking about the same things that you were doing. It seemed like that this is a real opportunity to be able to do this and to find the people and to be able to have the kinds of conversations that you want to have and to do the kind of work. How are you looking at it?
Well, you know, it's still, you know, I'm a scholar. And so it's still the scholarly networks that were in the 50s are still, you know, around now, you know, and that is generally the milieu.
I have it yet.
So it's like, but what's happening now is that it's much easier for me to figure out how to cross boundaries. I'm all about crossing boundaries in disciplines. So like today, I was working on a paper. I'm working on a paper about planetary intelligence. The idea that, you know, to what degree as planets evolve, is there cognitive, can you think of there being sort of, you know, global scale cognitive activity? So, you know, the Gaia hypothesis, which is something, you know, still very debatable, but there's aspects of that about microbial activity, how microbial activity, you know, sort of, you know, develops these feedbacks across the planet that can develop at least some control over the other coupled systems.
Right.
So, you know, that's a whole field. And so, you know, today I was looking at some papers about that. I was looking at papers on complex systems, complex adaptive systems, CAS. The view of what are called mitochondrial networks. These are the fungal networks between trees. Tree roots have these, and so the trees actually have, there's some kind of communication between trees in a forest. So I had to go look up at that. Now, it would have been much harder for me in 1950 to even find a paper on that. I would have to go to the library. And now it's like Google, Google, Google. I find the people who are interesting. Maybe I'll email them and say, hey, I'm looking for some help with this. So in that way, it's much easier to cut across disciplines and find scholars who, you know, are doing things.
I want to ask you this. I'm jumping on you right now because I would only talk for you for for years, but just that this place, would I recognize that the planet was alive? Would I even have the consciousness to be able to think about what life was if it is a life form?
Well, this is a huge, so the Gaia hypothesis is still, you know, so the Gaia hypothesis is a very interesting, has a very interesting history. You know, it was James Lovelock who first realized that the totality of life had, on the planet had completely altered the atmosphere. Like there would not be any oxygen in the atmosphere if it wasn't for the activity of life. And so that, you know, he was, had the idea that, look, you could use, if you could detect oxygen in a distant planet's atmosphere, that would be evidence that there was a biosphere there. So after he had that thought, he then began to sort of develop this, that what he eventually, with Lynn Margulis, the amazing, brilliant microbiologist, developed this idea that there, you know, that the planet functioned, was a superorganism in some sense, that developed feedback loops between its component parts that were able to keep the planet in, less like your body keeps your temperature stable.
Sure.
So now what's interesting about the Gaia is Gaia, the hypothesis got criticized a lot. First of all, because it got embraced by the New Age movement. So
Again. I tell you, yeah. we boomers have done it more and more and more. All right, anyway, so go ahead.
So what people really objected to was the idea of teleology, that evolution doesn't have a goal, right?
Yeah.
Margulis and Lovelock were very careful to say, we're not saying the planet's alive. We're saying the sum total of the biosphere or the biosphere as a whole exerts forcings that, you know, create feedbacks that can hold the planet. And they're evolutionary.
Yeah.
So there's been this long debate about whether or not that can happen. What's interesting, though, is that no matter what people thought about the Gaia hypothesis, that the basic tenet that the biosphere is a major driver for planetary evolution just completely got accepted and was then. So Gaia hypothesis turned into Earth system science, which is now the absolute bedrock of understanding Earth's evolution. So there's still the question. It's, you know, Gaia can still be some people will still argue about whether or not you can think of Gaia in evolutionary terms. But, you know, I find the idea very compelling, and I think there's a lot to it. And what's interesting now has been with exoplanets. We now the universe is full of planets, where now we can see those planets. So people now, there's this whole idea of exo-Gaia, and there's the, I'm doing some work on this, of looking at how all planets, in order for a planet to stay inhabited over long terms, it may need to establish these Gaian feedback. So it's, you know, the Gaia hypothesis is being resurrected again. In a way that people are looking at. So a lot of that early sort of pushback, they're still there, and I think there's some compelling arguments against it. But the overall architecture of the idea is still, I think, is now actually even more useful now that we have planets to look at, to look for life. And the way we're going to look at it has got to be through their atmospheres, by characterizing their atmospheres. The whole Gaian idea that biospheres control and, you know, determine the composition of atmospheres, that's central. That's central to our entire astrobiological effort.
Renee and I had a scientist on that was working on the Webb telescope that's going to be going up. And so, wow, that's going to give you a lot of information.
Yeah, no, it's true. You know, what people, I always want to, you know, have people understand. So this was the subject of my most recent book, The Light of the Stars, is that, we're that close to being able to have data about life on other worlds. You know, we've been arguing about it since the Greeks, but, you know, the Webb will be the beginning. And then the next generation of telescopes beyond that, the 100-meter telescopes whose mirror is the size of a football field. Those ones, we will really be able to characterize the atmospheres of these distant worlds. And from that, that means we're going to have data about life on other worlds. I don't know whether it's going to say there's life on other worlds, but instead of just yelling at each other about our opinions and our biases, we're going to have actual data to analyze. So it's we're like, you know, 20, 30 years away from a complete transformation in how we talk about life in the universe.
And I look at it just from a mathematical standpoint. How could you, in the laws of large numbers, not have this happen in other places.
Yeah, that's a really interesting thing. So this was in the book, The Light of the Stars. We did, a colleague of mine, Woody Sullivan, and I looked exactly at that problem. We wanted to see how all this data about exoplanets, right? We now know that pretty much every star in the sky has a planet or a family of planets, every star, except for the really big problem.
Yeah.
So every star you look at, you know, when you go out at night, they all have at least one world orbiting it. And, you know, 20% of them have worlds in the right place for life to form. Earth, you know, worlds like, you know, orbiting like the way the Earth orbits. So we did the calculation. That means that there are 10 billion trillion. That's my favorite number now. 10 billion trillion planets where the experiment has been run. The experiment with life and planets has been run.
Yeah.
So in order for us to be the only place it's ever happened, all 10 billion trillion of those worlds, except this one, the experiment failed. So, you know, now it's still possible. It is still, I mean, listen, it's not irrational. It's not irrational to say like, well, maybe the odds are 100 billion, one in 100 billion trillion, in which case we're the only one. But, you know, it does, you know, it now, with the way I phrase it, it now falls on the pessimists to explain how, with that many experiments being run, what filters are there? What, you know, what are the filters that keep life from ever forming? So, yeah, that's kind of the argument now. So it really is in the camp of the pessimists now to sort of give a compelling proof for why with 10 billion trillion experiments, they would all fail. But, you know, if that's true, that means that evolution or, you know, the laws of physics and chemistry are such that there really is this incredible barrier to allowing it to happen, even though it happened here.
Yeah. All right. So what's this third bucket that you're working
on? Well, the third bucket is aliens. The third bucket is I'm working in what is called technosignatures. So, you know, I'm sure you're aware of SETI, right? The Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. Yes. And, you know, that's a really cool field and everything. But it was never, this Woody Sullivan, the guy I talked about, who I collaborated with, Woody was when I was a graduate student at University of Washington in like 1988, yes. Woody was one of the professors there. And he was the only guy in the department who was working on SETI. Because in those days, SETI was kind of like, if you worked on SETI, everybody else was kind of like, fearless, you know. He was a great radio astronomer. But he was just interested in this problem, and he didn't give a blank about what anybody else thought. And so he and I would have great.
I'll say,
And so I always, you know, I never worked in it because I didn't. What I didn't like about traditional SETI was most of SETI was still and still is focused on beacons that somebody's sending us a signal, you know. And so then you got to do the sort of the honeymooners thing of like, well, if they know that we know that they know that we know. Then they know that. And so that was just like, I mean, it's useful, but it was a little too science fiction-y for me because you had to imagine what they, you know, what the alien civilization was thinking about. But with technosignatures, you know, with having all these planets, that whole game has changed, right? So now, you know, there's a huge amount of effort going into what we call biosignatures. Lots of people are calculating alternative biochemistries. You know, what are all the different ways that life might form? And how, from a distance, would we be able to see that in terms of atmospheric characteristics, right? So technosignatures says, look, you're going to be looking at these planets anyway. How do you know it's not going to be more common to find like some industrial solvent floating around in the atmosphere that you could detect? Or you know, some kind of megastructure that's going to, you know, pass across the planet while you're looking at it. How can you know for sure that that's not going to be the thing you see first? So you have to prepare. So there's this whole effort now to come up for biosignatures, to come up with a library, to, you know, theoretically come up with a library of possible biosignatures so that when we start looking and we see something weird, we can look at our library and go, oh, look, that's, you know. So for technosignatures, the effort now has got to be to do the same thing, right?
Because the laws of physics have to apply.
Exactly. Right. You know, and, you know, unless you're, you know, a technological civilization on another world, it's not going to be magic, you know, it's still going to be using the laws of physics. So, you know, so the question is what kinds of inadvertent signals might a civilization just going about its business? They're not sending us a signal. They're just doing their business. What kind of signal, what kind of imprint in the light we get from the planet might be there? And so that's so this effort. So I'm the principal investigator on the first grant that NASA has given to do, to think about intelligent life in 30 years. Because NASA got burned like in the 80s where, you know, they had a very good SETI program and Congress was like, this is a waste of money. Why are you doing this? So the NASA's like, okay, that's it. We're done. We're not going to touch this again. So now there is actually, Congress is now, it's a different generation. Congress is like, yeah, that sounds like a cool idea. So we're just starting this effort now, a sort of a, you know, the problem with SETI and technosignatures has been no money. Like everybody's doing it on, anybody who's doing it is doing it on the side. Now there's a little bit of research money for people to start trying to systematically think about this and figure out like what are good signatures, what are, you know, I mean, so we can stop just yelling at each other or arguing in the middle of the night over, you know, a beer, but to actually start doing some math and doing some work to sort of figure out, well, what would be detectable? What would be, you know, what might occur? Now this is, there's a lot of challenges in this, right? I mean, so you're going to start with what is, you're going to start with what's obvious, things that like we do, and then you got to figure out.
So, I mean, I want to ask how, all right, now we are light years, parsecs, whatever you want to do, some distance away, and we're trying to detect what's coming off of the Earth, and they're detecting what would they pick up, what would they be thinking, or what would they be able to pick up from?
If they had a big enough telescope, they could tell we were here. If they had a big enough telescope, they could see the lights at night. They could see they could see city lights.
Then we need that 100 meter. We got to invest in that 100. Right. Oh, come on,
you know,
man.
If they looked at the infrared, they would see heat spots from, you know, our activity. So, you know, yeah. So we're already in some ways, you know, marginally detectable. And imagine that we managed to make it through the Anthropocene and climate change. You know, we'll, you know, in another 200, 300 years, we may have large scale solar collectors, you know, on Mars, or not on Mars, on the moon or something, or we'll have them in space. Those might be detectable. We, you know, if you're using lasers to communicate, you know, it probably makes a lot more sense to communicate between interplanetary vehicles via laser than using radio. And those might be detectable. If you're in the right place, you might see a flash of laser, you know, across your, so, you know, civilizations will produce unintentional technosignatures. And so our job now is to kind of begin systematically imagining what those might be and which ones are, what would they look like? Which ones are going to be most detectable? Which ones are going to be most common? So what you really want here are the stuff you can't get away from, right? So if you're a civilization, you're using energy to do work. That's like the definition of civilization. You're harvesting energy from your planet and you're using it to do the work of building your civilization. The second law of thermodynamics says there's consequences of that. There's going to be, and there may be detectable consequences of that. So, yeah.
Well, I had, optimist, pessimist, where are you right now? Because one of the guys that I had on Reasonably Spontaneous Conversation, who is the head of biointegrity.net, is on a mission to that. Okay, the Earth is in the intensive care. So all he's doing is working on the lungs and the heart. You know, what are they doing? Rebuying back rainforest Amazon, getting it to the Native America, well, they are Americans.
Indigenous population.
Yeah, the indigenous population so that they can, so that because it's so cheap to buy it, and so they can get and then start planting and getting the big resources there, the coral reefs. What is your, from your scientists, are we on the edge? Are we gonna, are we ahead of the curve? Are we behind the curve? Or what, I don't know how to ask this question, Adam.
Yeah, well,
I
mean, am I optimistic about the human future?
Yeah.
So, I get asked this question a lot since this is, you know, what the last book was about. And I did a lot of, you know, book tours about this. And so my answer is yes, I'm optimistic because what's the alternative? You know, would suck. So, but I really think, you know, my gut feeling is that there are other civilizations that have made it through this, that, you know, my whole argument in the book and some of the research I'm doing is that this kind of transition, the Anthropocene, as it's called, the entry into the Anthropocene is probably not uncommon, that, you know, once a civilization learns how to harvest energy large scale from its planet, it goes through exponential growth and it runs up against the limits of the planet. And so I feel somebody's figured it out. So we could figure it out too. Now, whether we will figure out is totally, I don't know. You know? Yeah. Because the way I like to put it is the metaphor is we are a cosmic teenager, right? We're as a species, as a civilization, we are entering our adolescence. And as we know from adolescence is a dangerous phase. Like, you know, you gain power over yourself, but it's not clear at all that you have wisdom. And, you know, you may drive, you know, you get the keys to the planet, but you may drive the planet off a cliff. So, I guess we're just going to have to see. Hopefully, you know, I mean, human beings are capable of amazing things. We're also capable of profound stupidity. Let's see what happens. I'm hopeful, yeah. You know, but it's going to require some pretty profound evolutionary changes in us. But of course, you know, evolution, the only reason a species only evolves when there's a gun at its head, so to speak, right? You know, there's got to be evolutionary pressure. It's got to be selective pressure.
Right.
So, you know, this is selective pressure for us about whether or not, you know, we join the cosmic winners or the cosmic losers in all this.
Is there any reason for you to believe that a human being would be the end of evolution, or whether or not we are just a link along an evolutionary continuing chain?
Oh yeah, we're a link. I mean, why would, you know, I mean, especially given the fact that we have the power to change ourselves,
yeah.
You know, genetic engineering means that, like, I doubt in, you know, 100,000 years that human beings look they're going to look pretty different, you know, in ways that may be like really freaky deaky and startling, but sure. I would just imagine that, you know, I mean, because listen, you know, Homo sapiens are only like 300,000 years
old.
I know.
We have to play that long. Are you kidding?
Yeah. So, you know, if we make it much longer, you know, if we make it, I mean, one of the problems, so I'll have to end after this, so you'll excuse me, but my parting words here will be
one of
the difficulties in thinking about technosignatures. I was just lucky to be part of a paper that David Kipping, brilliant paper that he put together, where he calculated, did the probability estimates for, if you have a whole bunch of different kinds of civilizations, young civilizations and old civilizations, who are you most likely to encounter? And it turns out, you know, it's kind of intuitive, you're most likely to encounter the much older civilizations. And so then the question is, a civilization that lasts for 100 million years, which is older than, like, the dinosaurs died 62 million years ago, What is it even like? What are you even like then? Like, are you post-biological? Are you post-biological and then re-biological? Have you integrated yourself into the laws of physics? I mean, that's a real challenge. And that's something I'm really interested in thinking about now, is like, how do you even imagine a technological species that has had 100 million years of, you know, maybe you just come to a stasis, like, okay, yeah, the technology, you know, I mean, look at cars, right? We're about to go through perhaps we developed the engine, the internal combustion engine, you know, 100 years ago, and it's changed, but it hasn't changed that much. We've been like tinkering on the edges, right? Now we have electric vehicles, yay. But like really the basic, you know, overall these basic ideas, they've been around. Like electric cars, people thought about electric cars 100 years ago. So, you know, maybe your technology just plateaus. But either way, you know, the real question here is if we last long enough, what will we become? Yeah.
Curiosity, I do not believe will ever plateau. And as long as you have that, that's where you are. Thank you so much, Adam. What a ball.
It was a pleasure. Thank you. I really enjoyed this conversation.
It was hilarious. All right.
Talk to the place.
All right. Talk to you. Bye-bye.